This podcast is made by and for internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while vetted by residents, is not personally verified by our hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represented are our own and out of the University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome
to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back from the holidays and for another exciting edition of the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. Jumping right into it, so JP, when I have a patient with cirrhosis, there's a lot of reasons they can be thrombocytopenic. But one of the ones that I usually don't consider too much, but I probably should, is cryoglobulinemia. And I heard Laura gave a great presentation about this. Can you fill me in on that?
Yeah, of course I can. She actually gave a great talk about hepatitis C-related cryoglobulinemia. But before we get started, let's get some definitions so we can all level the playing field in terms of what we're referring to. Cryoglobulin is an IgG that's in the serum that precipitates at a temperature below 37 degrees, and they redissolve with warming. So that's what a cryoglobulin is. A cryoglobulinemia refers to the presence of a cryoglobulin in someone's serum. Now, a cryoglobulinemic vasculitis, or cryoglobulinemia syndrome, is the inflammation and the damage to the blood vessels that results from a cryoglobulin that's precipitating. Three different things, right? Cryoglobulin is a protein, cryoglobulinemia is the presence of the protein in the blood, and cryoglobulinemic vasculitis is the actual damage that results from that protein aggregating and depositing in the tissues. So cryoglobulinemias, there's different types based on the kind of protein that's produced. There's three. Type 1 is monoclonal immunoglobulins, typically IgM or IgG. Type 2 is a mixture of monoclonal IgM with rheumatoid factor activity and a polyclonal immunoglobulin. This is the one that's typically associated to hepatitis C. So I'll say that again. In a mixed cryo, you have a monoclonal IgM, that's a rheumatoid factor positive, and a polyclonal immunoglobulin. And this is a typical one that's associated with not only hepatitis C, but also hepatitis B, HIV, and other autoimmune diseases like lupus and Sjogren's. The type 3 cryoglobulinemia is basically a mixture of polyclonal IgGs of all isotypes and a polyclonal IgM. So basically all types of antibodies mixed and matched together and depositing in temperatures under 37 degrees. This is secondary, most often to autoimmune disorders, but can also be present with hepatitis C. So what's the typical presentation associated to the cryoglobulinemic vasculitis associated to hepatitis C? Arthralgias are present in about 40 to 70% of patients. Purpura, 60 to 80% of patients. Only about half have renal involvement. And the peripheral neuropathy can also be present in a variable number of patients. Rare manifestations of this particular type of vasculitis, GI involvement, and importantly, pulmonary involvement. So the diagnostic testing, as we were mentioning before, so cryoglobulin precipitates under 37 degrees. So basically what you do is you take the patient's serum, you put it at 4 degrees, and you see if it precipitates. This can take a while, which is why cryos sometimes take a while to come back. And it's a first a qualitative and then a quantitative assay, right? Qualitative, you'll put them at 4 degrees, you check them every day. If something precipitates, then cryopositive, and then you do the quantitative, and then you try to differentiate what immunoglobulins are actually there. What other things can you do? Well, you check a rheumatoid factor, as we said, in hepatitis C mixed cryo, which again is an IgM that acts as rheumatoid factor. You have rheumatoid factor activity. Complement levels. So based on the way cryos generate damage, you're going to have a C4 that's low or even undetectable with a normal to low normal C3. So your complements are going to be low C4 that are typically seen in cryo versus other diseases that activate both pathways of the complement that lower C3 and C4. The most common ones, right, infection or lupus associated that decrease both. Histopathology, you can see MPGN if you do a renal biopsy. That's membrana proliferative glomerulonephritis, big word. And you can also see vasculitis of the perineural and the endoneural vessels. So basically vasculitis of the blood vessels that are supplying the nerves. And basically, the pathogenesis is just clonal expansion of B cells. And this happens in the setting of chronic infection that keeps sort of stimulating B cells to produce these immunoglobulins that end up depositing as immune complexes. So what's the treatment? The treatment for Hep C-related cryoglobulin, the treatment for most, if not all, cryoglobulinemic vasculitis is you treat the underlying disease. You treat whatever is causing that clonal B cell proliferation. In this case, you treat the either infection, you know, Hep C, Hep B, HIV, or you treat the autoimmune disease.
So JP, living here in Tennessee, I feel like I have a pretty good handle on different types of fungal diseases, but when my differential gets down to mucor, that's when I start to scare myself. But I heard Anjali gave us a great presentation trying to highlight some of the basics of mucormycosis. Can you fill me in on that?
Yeah, of course I can. NG gave us an incredibly interesting talk on a fungal infection that we learned a lot about, I think, in medical school. Let's go over it. She focused on zygomycosis or mucormycosis in the solid organ transplant recipients. And she had three clinical questions that we'll just answer briefly, which is the incidence of zygomycosis in solid organ transplant patients, the risk factors for the infection, and how do immunosuppressant medications affect the susceptibility to infection, either making you more likely to get the infection or actually able to fight off the infection. In terms of what the, you know, clinical presentations from Mucor, there's three types. The rhinoorbital cerebral, which is the one that we all have nightmares about with the patients, the diabetic patients that have these infections, pulmonary mucor, and then cutaneous mucor. So what actually is the incidence of invasive fungal species, and particularly mucor in the solid organ transplant patients? It's actually relatively low. The two that take the cake in terms of the highest incidence are going to be Candida and Aspergillus. And after Aspergillus in Canada, then comes zygomycosis. Overall, the numbers are actually relatively low. So if you look at percentage-wise, it's only 2% patients in solid organ transplant patients. This is a cohort of about 300 kidney transplants, 378 liver transplants. So, and what are the risk factors for zygomycosis? Within the solid organ transplant patients, so this is just with transplant patients, she identified four, which is diabetes, big one, renal failure at baseline or dialysis at baseline, as well as a retransplantation, so the need for re-immunosuppression going through the entire cocktail of induction again. Interestingly enough, with an odds ratio of 10.9, prior voriconazole or caspofungin use. So Mucor is scary. Now imagine that. If you've been on Vori for any other reason, particularly here in Histoplasma Valley. The last question is, how do immunosuppressant medications actually affect the susceptibility to infection? This has a pretty cool answer because the glucocorticoids actually make you more likely to get the infection, right? So they put you at risk for mucor. But interestingly enough, tacrolimus, or FK506, is protective. Turns out that the zygomycetes are dimorphic fungi, and they'll show either highfall or yeast growth depending on the conditions around them, and they depend on calcineurin to switch between yeast and hyphae forms. So if you block calcineurin, they can't do that. If you block calcineurin, then you actually inhibit fungal growth. So tacro was actually protective against mucor. Other risks associated to immunosuppression, type 2 diabetes, which interestingly enough, tacro does put you at a risk of developing diabetes, as we all know. And type 2 diabetes by itself, right, leads to macrophage dysfunction and changing the iron stores, actually favoring zygomycetes growth. As I said, so solid organ transplant patients on active immunosuppression are at risk. The most common presentations, the rhino, orbital, cerebral, pulmonary, and cutaneous mucor. Risk factors in terms of immunosuppressant medications, glucocorticoids, MMF, and then the type 2 diabetic effect, which relates to immunosuppression.
So JP, when I'm in primary care clinic, I end up getting a lot of lipid panels, and I primarily look for your total cholesterol, your LDL, but one thing I don't pay attention to as much is the HDL. But I heard Alicia gave us a presentation on what should our differential be in the management of a very low HDL.
Yeah, so Alicia presented a case of a 40-year-old gentleman with coronary artery disease that was admitted for V-fib arrest. And the take-home message from that was he was thin, non-smoker, non-diabetic, but turns out his HDL was incredibly low. So she basically gave us a great discussion of the metabolism of lipoproteins in the body. So Alicia made a great case for HDL, a low HDL, being an independent risk factor for coronary artery disease and vascular disease as a whole, independent of other risk factors, including LDL level, triglyceride level. And she presented some data from the original Framingham study from JAMA 1986, which basically showed us that you know, low HDL was a risk factor for the development of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, and high HDL was actually protective against it in the effect size along the lines of change associated with age. So I don't want to go through all the biochemistry, especially on the podcast, but in summary, she said there's monogenic dyslipidemias like the patient that she presented have to be considered when the HDL is less than 35, and particularly when the HDL is less than 20. And this will increase the risk of premature coronary disease significantly. The total cholesterol to HDL ratio is going to be an incredibly strong predictor of coronary disease, so that's something that we should take a look at. And in patients with a history of coronary disease, diabetes, or very high risk for coronary artery disease, cholesterol to HDL ratio should be less than 4. This is, again, according to Canadian guidelines, and there's been a lot of recent data on this. So this was sort of one of the more newer and recommendations that are around, essentially targeting that total cholesterol to HDL level. And there was some debate, niacin or fibrate therapy in conjunction with a statin in a patient with dyslipidemia and HDL less than 40. Again, data's still out, still worth considering sort of the risks and benefits. There's no hard evidence pointing that it's beneficial, but just something to consider.